Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'll be talking with Virginia Gray and Jennifer Benz, who are the co-authors, along with David Lowery, of Interest Groups and Healthcare Reform Across the United States. Virginia, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Thanks for having us.
Great, and Jennifer, you're there too.
Yes, thanks so much for having us on today.
Wonderful. I've enjoyed the book a lot, and I think everyone who reads it will. Before we get to it, Virginia, maybe you can, as the lead author, just give a little more introduction to who you are. Maybe also you're the co-author who's not on the call, and then Jennifer, we can hear a little bit about yourself. So, Virginia, maybe you could talk about your very illustrious career and where you are now.
Well, now I'm at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and I overlapped with David here. But he and I have been longtime co-authors for at least 25 years. And he, after I arrived here, he then to the Netherlands, but he's back in the United States now. He's at Penn State University. And we're both interested in interest groups, but I was the one who developed an interest in healthcare, and that was partly because I was on the board of a large HMO in Minneapolis, 750,000 members, and it was consumer governed, and I became a chair of that board at, toward the end of my stay there, and so I was familiar with the HMOs, kind of from the perspective of the industry, and also we often went to a lot of national meetings and retreats and seminars, so I learned a lot more there. So that made me think that I at least knew a little bit about healthcare.
Yeah, wonderful. And who among us can claim not to have cited Gray and Lowery or Lowery and Gray at one point in the recent past? And so it's a real pleasure to talk with you. And Jennifer, you're in a different place now. What about your own background and where you are now?
Yeah, I am a senior research scientist with the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs, which is a center at NORC at the University of Chicago. And prior to coming here, I was a PhD student at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and had the great fortune of getting to work with Virginia as her research assistant, and getting on board this project with Virginia and Dave. And my research has long focused on how citizen preferences and opinions get translated into for policymakers and into policy. So I've spent a great deal of time on public opinion work, but also looked at that same question through the angle of interest groups.
Wonderful. Now, Virginia, we've heard just a little bit about the bits and pieces, how you three came together. But I wonder if you talk, and you talked a little bit about this in your preface, about was this the book that you originally set out to write? This book is a long time in the making. When you started, is this what you envisioned publishing in 2013?
Oh, no, we envisioned publishing it much sooner than that, as people always do. But Dave and I were funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation in their senior investigator program. And this is a program to try to get scholars who are not experts in health policy to draw them into the field. Other, you know, people who are in social science who apply their expertise to problems in health policy. So we had this a data set that we'd already assembled on interest groups, and they were gracious enough to give us a three-year grant to set our minds to doing something with that and applying it to health policy. And we published a lot of articles at first, but Robert Wood Johnson really likes books. So it was always in my mind at the end to write a book. But when it came time to write the book, it's when we asked Jenny to join us, and she has a lot of healthcare knowledge, and she also did the final data analysis for the book.
Yeah, and you know, I think this makes such a contribution to the field of interest group research and also to healthcare, health policy research and also state policy research. Jenny, maybe we can talk a little bit about kind of the foundation, the background onto which your analysis in the book is written. You write in the book, and I'm quoting here, although organized interests have been blamed for blocking reform in Washington for nearly 100 years, the same interests exist in the 50 state capitals where successful reforms have nonetheless been achieved. You write then, this is the central research puzzle of the book. I wonder if you could talk about how similar the interests are at the national and state levels. Are we mainly talking about the same affiliates of national organizations, or are there a different array operating in some capitals versus others?
Sure, yeah. So exactly as you say, interest organizations have long been sort of pegged as the culprit for the myriad of failed healthcare reform attempts at the federal level. And we were seeing states able to achieve reform at their level of government. So, of course, the immediate question we wanted to explore was that, you know, maybe there are simply fewer interests working at the state capitals than there are in Washington, thus making it easier for reforms to pass. So we took a look at some federal data compiled by Frank Baumgartner and Beth Leach from the lobbying disclosure reports from the late 90s, and we compared that to the state-level lobby registrations that Virginia and Dave put together in the data set that she just mentioned. And when we looked at the data, it was quickly apparent that on any number of different facets of how you wanted to cut the data, less representation at the state level was not the case. So healthcare interest organizations in Washington were about 13% of all registered interest organizations, and at the state capitals, it was slightly more, up to 16%. And in both cases, healthcare interests represented the biggest category of interest organizations. Furthermore, healthcare interests at the state level were one of the fastest growing interest sectors in the 90s. And the three sort of case studies, policy case studies that we look at in the book sort of had their some of the biggest action happening in the late 90s. So healthcare interests at the state level increased by 49% between 1990 and 1997. And then sort of taking a slightly different look at the data, the distribution of healthcare interest organizations, every state capital had registrations from provider associations and hospital associations. Big groups like PhRMA and the Health Insurance Association of America were represented in 40 or more states. And then individual companies like Blue Cross Blue Shield were also registered in a majority of the states.
Now, this book is both very empirical, and you guys have collected up a lot of data, a database that you guys have alluded to a couple of times. But, Virginia, this book also confronts and tries to make a sense of the big strands of theory in these areas. And what you use as the central construct of the book is this policy innovation theory. Wonder if you can briefly for us describe what this is, and then how you try to incorporate this into your empirical analysis in the book.
Yes, we used innovation theory, which I started working on. I hate to say how long ago this was, but I started working on that idea in my dissertation many years ago. But of course, it's changed a great deal by this time. And then also we used our own theory about interest groups, which is the ESA model, Energy Stability Area model. But first let me tell you about the policy innovation theory. So we used that to explain all the factors that might go into influencing a state's decision to adopt one of these reforms that we were studying, aside from the interest group configuration. So kind of everything else besides the interest groups. So there's really three elements to that theory that we were interested in. And the first is what we call the problem environment. So sort of how big is the need for this reform? A typical measure of need might be the percent that are uninsured in the state. And then the second element is the resources that the states have, because many healthcare programs are expensive, and so state wealth is also often important. And then the third major element is the political climate. And, of course, as political scientists, we're very interested in that. So that includes things like who controls the branch of the government, the Republicans or the Democrats. And then we call all those three elements kind of interim determinants. They're internal to the state. But what interested me when I first started on political science about innovation theory was it also incorporated external elements to the state. And one of those is horizontal diffusion. So states are more likely to adopt a program that's new to them if their neighboring states have already adopted it, because that's kind of who they look to for validation that a program is successful. And then also there's an element of vertical diffusion, which has been less studied. But in this research project, we measured that by the national media coverage that these different reforms got, thinking that would put pressure on states to adopt if there was a lot of media coverage about this particular innovation.
Now, one of the things that's worth noting is the various reforms, and we'll talk about those in a moment, that you guys study, all take place prior to the most recent national level Affordable Care Act. And so these ideas of where the ideas behind each policy reform in many ways are most hotly debated and turned over at the state level. I wonder if you guys can talk about your choices of which specific health care reforms at the state level to study, because you mentioned in the book there's a sort of five areas, and you look at these cases. So how did you choose? And maybe you can start to talk a little bit about what you found in each one of these areas, because they each work a little bit differently.
Well, let me start by talking about why we chose these three different policies. And it goes back to what Jenny talked about with the comparing what's gone on at the state level with the federal level. So I was struck by the fact that a number of reforms had been carried out at the state level, but at the national level, hardly anything was going on at all. And it further struck me that if interest groups were the culprit, you know, we've got the same interest group structure as Jenny just described. We've got the same interest group structure at the state level as at the national level. And so, you know, why are they stopping reforms at the national level, but they're not stopping them at the state level? So that was kind of the puzzle. And also, we wanted to choose, basically these were just the things that were hot on the agenda at the time we started our study, to tell the truth. But the other thing is we wanted policies that the state alone decides on and the state alone funds. We don't want joint federal-state programs. And people were always coming along and saying to me, oh, you ought to be studying this, you ought to be studying that, because, of course, that was what they were studying, so that's what they always think you should be studying. But the politics of what they were studying, a joint federal-state program, is entirely different from a state-only program. And that's what we wanted to study. We wanted to take the federal influence out of it so we could compare the states. And so the state pharmaceutical programs started back in the 70s, and we covered those up until 2003 when the President Bush got the Medicare Modernization Act passed, and then we continued to follow them, but their nature changed after that point. And then in the 90s, the HMO, anti-HMO regulations were a very hot topic. And at the national level, they had passed both houses and went to conference committee and just languished. They never became a law. But at the state level, it was just like a policy bandwagon. You know, states couldn't pass these fast enough. They all loved passing these. And then universal coverage. Hawaii was the first state that passed this. And a number of states tried different things after that. There are a lot of barriers to states actually being able to do this. But, you know, the federal government had been, or at least the presidents had tried for 100 years before President Obama actually got the Affordable Care Act passed. And in fact, until Christmas Eve of 2009, when it was on the floor of Congress, that was the first time it ever even gotten to the floor of the Congress. So it's just quite a tale about, you know, how the states were doing things that the federal government somehow wasn't able to do.
Yeah, and Jenny, in the title of the book, you guys draw attention both to interest groups, but also to money and the importance of money. Sort of in the totality of what you found, and this is kind of the big question that people always want to know is, you know, so talk to us about money and the relative importance of it. Is it important in different ways in different states, or is there any kind of generalization that can be reached about how influential money is in state health care reform policymaking?
Sure, yeah. We didn't have focus a ton of the analyses looking at financial contributions, but we did do one particular analysis where we looked at the role of money in conjunction with straight lobby registrations. We were very fortunate to be able to take advantage of the National Institute on Money and State Politics database. And what we basically did was look up individually all of the registered health lobby organizations in Virginia and Dave's data set, and we tried to figure out if they had an active political action committee making contributions in the health sector at that time. And we found something fairly interesting, in that when we looked at all the PAC money going to state candidates from the health sector, we found that 76% of the contributions came from PACs who were affiliated with a lobbying group. But as you might expect, the money isn't coming equally from all registered lobbying groups and from all different types of lobbying groups. And in fact, when we looked closely at the data, we saw that, you know, of the over 10,000 health groups who were registered to lobby, only 14% of them have an active PAC. So that, you know, tells us that in the late 90s, when much of this state-level health reform was taking place, PAC contributions were largely the province of organizations already engaged in lobbying, but that very few of those lobbying organizations had a PAC strategy at their disposal.
Now, Virginia, I wonder, you started the conversation talking about how this book and the subject matter fits into a long career study of this topic. And we now have this federal act in place. And the question becomes, and you guys address this in the book, about implementation. So as we wind this down, I wonder if you talk at all about where you sit and what you see in terms of the implementation by states. Some states saying, no, we are not going to. Other states, we're going to aggressively. But what's your sense of where state implementation sits right now? How does that fit into the conclusions we can draw from your book?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. And the Affordable Care Act really gives three roles to the states. And this, the first one is to set up and run these state exchanges for individuals and for small businesses. And that's that's in the context of the private insurance marketplace. And then the federal government will offer subsidies for people who are not well off. Now, about half the states have decided to do this, and about half the states said they're not going to do this. And if they elect not to, then that means the federal government will do it for them. And so we see both politics and interest groups coming in here, because about two-thirds of those states that have said they're going to participate, that are going to have these exchanges, most of those are Democrats, and of the states that are not going to have exchanges, almost all of those are Republican. And then the second role, of course, has to do with Medicaid. So it was envisioned there would be a significant expansion of Medicaid in states, but then the Supreme Court made that just a choice, something states can take it or leave it. And, of course, it's very financially beneficial for states, because right now it's 100% funded and eventually be 90% funded. And what has happened is that about half the states are doing this, and about half are not doing this. And so the ones, again, that aren't participating are tend to be the Republican states, although there's definitely some Republicans that are participating. So it's not quite as it's not wholly one or the other. And also the ones that are not participating tend to have the most uninsured. In other words, they need this the most. And so an example would be Texas, which has one of the highest percentages of unemployed uninsured citizens, 28%. And they're adamantly against participating in the Medicaid expansion. And then there's a lot of interest group pressure to participate, though, because the interest groups that represent the hospitals, especially, and the pharmaceutical companies, they want their states to participate, because it represents will represent a bigger market for them, and of course they're all for that. And then the third role is there's a lot of the state having to oversee the regulation of a lot of new regulations in the marketplace, and some of that is that rise in the cost of health insurance premiums. Then there's a lot of consumer protections, like for pre-existing conditions. And one that's been very popular is that health insurance companies can't spend more than 80% of the premium dollar on anything but medical care. And so the states are in charge of, you know, ascertaining that. And so the interest groups are going to play a significant role in that, you know, in that area. And they're going to be, they're always good at looking at the details, you know, the devil's in the details. And interest groups are always in there looking at the details, which, of course, we as citizens aren't. We're neither have the expertise nor usually the interest in looking at those details. So I
think, you know,
the main ways our study links up with the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, the details of the book are just very, very interesting. I think there's so much that from a number of different perspectives people can learn from this. Now, before we finish up, Jenny, you mentioned that you're at NORC. can we get a little, maybe a brief snapshot of what your current research agenda is? Do you have another book project that is going to be in your near future, or do you have other research pursuits ahead of you?
Sure, yeah. I actually I started at NORC mostly as a health services researcher doing survey research work for large federal evaluation projects. But after I finished my PhD in political science, I came back to NORC, and we've been working on starting up this new partnership with the Associated Press, and the goal of our center is to sort of try and fill in the gap of social science research and high-quality public opinion research that journalists can use in their reporting and for informing policymakers. So we've got a whole host on a variety of subjects of studies that we've been working on lately, and I will leave the door open to maybe a future book project down the road.
Right. Well, you have to promise to come back and talk about that. And Virginia, this is another in a long line of really interesting publications for you. Is there something on your desk that you see coming out soon? Are you continuing to work on healthcare, or have you something new that you're working on?
No, I'm working on a variety of different things, but none that have to do with healthcare at the moment. So I have four or five different papers I'm trying to get out the door this summer, and then with Dave Laurie and another fellow, we're working on an edited book on population ecology models applied in a whole different set of contexts of both European and U.S. So that'll be quite an unusual venture.
Well, I hope that when that comes out, you'll come back also and talk about it. And until these future books come out, the current one, Interest Groups and Healthcare Reform Across the United States, has been published by Georgetown University Press, by our guests Virginia Gray and Jennifer Benz, and also David Lowry, who wasn't with us today. Virginia and Jennifer, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.